We're introducing legislation to implement a national freeze on handgun ownership. What this means is that it will no longer be possible to buy, sell, transfer, or import handguns anywhere in Canada. In other words, we're capping the market.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau yesterday announcing significant gun control legislation that would also include a government buyback of military-style assault weapons. Trudeau pointed to the United States as an example where gun violence keeps getting worse and harder to fight. However, Canada does not have the Second Amendment and the deeply entrenched belief in the right to bear arms that comes with it. We're going to talk about gun control, what's legal, what's not, and how malleable the Second Amendment might be with Jessica Levinson. She teaches at Loyola Law School and is our regular legal here on Press Play. Hi there.
Hi there.
Well, let me play another clip of tape from another head of state, President Biden. He was in Uvalde on Sunday, and here he is on, well, before he went, on the South Lawn with Marine One in the background.
The Constitution, the Second Amendment, was never absolute. You couldn't buy a cannon when the Second Amendment was passed. You couldn't go out and purchase a lot of weaponry.
Okay, it's hard to hear, but he says basically the Second Amendment was never absolute. And yet somehow it feels like it is right now in this country. How do we get to this point?
I think honestly based on a misunderstanding and maybe based on political convenience. So if we take this for a moment outside of the Second Amendment, let's just think about the one that comes before that, the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. No law doesn't mean no law. And just because we have an individual right to bear arms, that doesn't mean that that right can't be burdened. What we're talking about here is really prong number one, or as I'm going to say to my students tonight, step one. Step one is there a right that exists? Step two is, when can we burden that right? So the idea that the Second Amendment is absolute, that you can never place restrictions, I would say, look at the First Amendment. We have defamation law. We have obscenity. We have rules against incitement that you and I have talked about a lot mm-hmm. on this show. So it's really, I think for some people, it's political convenience to keep that misunderstanding going, but it's not an absolute right. And frankly, none of the court cases indicate, none of the Supreme Court cases indicate that it is.
Well, let's talk about one of them in particular that has received a ton of attention for perhaps ushering in this idea, false as you say it is, that the Second Amendment is an absolute. And that is the Heller decision from when was it? 2008 that was argued. So a while ago. Tell us about that decision and what it did.
Heller decision, a really famous, and I think maybe the last really big Second Amendment decision. Of course, there's one pending that maybe we'll be able to talk about today. But what the court said in Heller that was so important is that the right to bear arms isn't just for members of the military. It's for individuals. And the thing that Justice Scalia, in writing for the majority, said, again, that was so and legally groundbreaking, is that this is an individual right. It is something that you and I hold. It doesn't mean, again, that it can't be burdened, but it means that it exists regardless of whether or not we are in the military. What he's really saying is that militia is not equivalent to military. Militia is a much broader term. And obviously it's a long opinion. It's more complex than that, but that's what it boils down to. And that's why ever since Heller, we have had every lower court since, you're right, 2008, interpreting gun control legislation against the backdrop of the understanding that, yes, there is an individual right to bear arms.
But he also said, Scalia also said, that this right can be regulated. He said, and I'm quoting here, "Nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings." And so why isn't that brought up when it comes to legislation on Capitol Hill?
I think you're exactly right. And so you're exactly right to emphasize that. And that's the kind of prong two that we've been talking about. You know, number one is the right recognized. Heller says yes. Number two, can we burden it? Yes. Heller says yes. And for Justice Scalia, I'll note that he does use the words longstanding. But if you read the opinion and if you read how I think we should interpret the opinion, it is the idea that some legislation is in fact permissible. So why don't we bring this up? I will say, I think some people do. It's not talked about enough, but if you don't want to pass legislation, or if you just want to say it's too hard, or we're not sure what's going to happen in court, or it might be struck down, then you can just give the, you know, headline of Heller, there's an individual right to bear arms, but not go down to this really important point that you point out and that is quoted directly from the case, which is, of course, some restrictions are permissible, even under this broad reading of the Second Amendment.
Okay, well, that brings us to now and the court today and the decision and the case before it, likely to be handed down in the next couple of weeks, I suppose. You know, we end the term at the end of June. And so this is a big case out of New York. It's a gun case, a concealed carry case. Tell us about that one.
So this is a case that was argued on November 8th. I think it is the last case that was argued in November that has not yet been decided, which may not be a coincidence given recent events. And this is exactly what you said. This is about how states can limit the ability of people to get concealed carry permits. And specifically in New York, they require that people give basically a really good reason, not just a general, I want this concealed carry permit for self-defense, but something a little bit more specific and particular than that. There are about, I think, six other states that have restrictions like New York. And so and California is one of them. And so those restrictions could fall if the court, as everybody suspected after oral arguments again on November 8th, if the court does in fact strike down that restriction. And again, the striking down of that restriction doesn't mean all restrictions. It means that particular one, in the view of this particular court, goes too far.
But I wonder, like Heller, if that could be used by other courts, lower courts, to interpret it more broadly, to talk about restrictions in general.
Absolutely, yes. And I think this is what we see. We see this in every area, in the sense that we don't know exactly what some cases mean until there's the next case. Sometimes the next case comes from the Supreme Court. Sometimes we have what we did with Heller, where we have over a decade of lower courts trying to interpret what exactly the court meant. We talked about the fact that Justice Scalia said, look, some restrictions are okay. And we've spent more than a decade now, judges throughout the country, trying to figure out which are okay. But I think it is absolutely true that if the court strikes down this New York restriction, then we're going to see some judges saying, well, that just shows how robust the Second Amendment is, and we need to be really careful about other restrictions. We have to be really careful to read the opinion, the details of the opinion, before we decide to stretch or narrow that case, obviously.
Hmm. Well, speaking of lower courts, here in California, a lower court has struck down two laws that California had. One was an outright ban on assault weapons, and the other one was having an age restriction. Basically, California had a ban on selling assault weapons to anyone under the age of 21. That was struck down by two judges, I think, appointed by Trump. Is that right?
That is right. I think a Ninth Circuit judge and a district court judge. And it shows you that when you haven't had guidance from the court for a while, that, and the guidance is frankly kind of broad, that it allows you to go in different directions. And we certainly have some judges, particularly appointed by Republican presidents, who are saying, no, I'm looking at Heller, and this is not okay under the Second Amendment. You have some judges saying the opposite. And so we're going to get more cases from the Supreme Court. And this court will take more Second Amendment cases that tell us for sure what is and isn't permissible. And that's the best way that we can get a roadmap. But right now, lower court judges, as we've just talked about too, they have a lot of discretion to tell us what is permissible.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and our regular legal here on Press Play. Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, are movie theaters back? Why Top Gun was such a winner over the weekend? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The movie industry has been in a tailspin for the last 2 years because of the pandemic. But thanks to a blast from the past, there is hopes of a turnaround. Top Gun Maverick broke the Memorial Day box office record. The follow-up to the iconic 1986 movie grossed $156 million here in the U.S. and more than $250 million worldwide. It was the biggest premiere weekend of Tom Cruise's career, so 40 years' worth of openings for him. With the pandemic ongoing, it's still probably safer to play volleyball on the beach, but many are hoping Top Gun's success signals a strong summer for moviegoing, especially when you factor in who went to see Top Gun Maverick. People 35 years and older. Joining us to talk about this is Ryan Fonder, Hollywood business reporter for the LA Times and author of their Wide Shot newsletter. Hi.
Hi.
All right. What was the big attraction with Top Gun? Why did so many people want to go see that?
Well, Top Gun has been positioned for the last, 2 years or so as the movie that is going to get older audiences back into theaters. And the movie that really has to be seen in a movie theater. I mean, yes, this is a film that is a sequel to a 36-year-old piece of intellectual property, but Tom Cruise and the producers and the director have been hitting the pavement around Hollywood and around the industry to say, this is a movie that you need to see on the big screen. This is sort of our coming out party for the big screen experience. Even though there have been movies that have done well post-pandemic, like The Batman and Doctor Strange, this is oddly the case maker that, you know, something other than Marvel and superheroes and spandex can get people out and go see movies.
Yeah, but it's sort of a similar idea, right? Isn't Tom Cruise kind of like a superhero?
Tom Cruise is very much a superhero. He's kind of made himself into his own action franchise hero that is now single-handedly basically fueling two different action franchises between this and the Mission Impossible series. And by the way, there's another Mission Impossible movie coming out next year. So look forward to that. And so this is basically why people, including the New York Times, have been calling Tom Cruise the last living movie star who can basically give a studio a boost and bring people out to the theater seemingly by force of will.
Yeah. Well, so who came to see it? Was it all four quadrants, as they like to say?
It was. I mean, there's been a lot of focus on the over 35 crowd, as is expected, because that's the demographic that has been least likely to return to theaters and most hesitant post-COVID slowdown. And this is, you know, partly because of lingering fears of the virus, of course, but it's mostly because people have just gotten out of the habit of going at a certain mm-hmm. demographic. And the argument in Hollywood has been, well, we should expect that because there hasn't been that much for them to see. That's really a draw. And this is really supposed to be the breaking point for all that. We will see if that translates into the next string of movies. There's still a lot of stuff out there that is primarily made for 12-year-old boys. The Jurassic World Dominion is coming up. A lot of family films like Lightyear and the next Minions movie are on deck. But hope springs eternal, as they say.
Right. And so what are theater owners saying? Are they saying we're back and we don't have to close down any more theaters now?
Yeah, I mean, and take it with a grain of salt, because you still see, I mean, in the LA market, there's a lot of musical chairs going on still with the smaller theater chains that really cater to the kind of older specialty movie-going crowd. The Landmark Pico location just closed down, and that company actually picked up the old Lemley location at the Pasadena Playhouse and picked up the lease there, and the ArcLight is still closed in Hollywood, and the Vista in Los Feliz, which is my local movie palace, really is still closed for renovations. But there seems to be some light at the end of the tunnel. They just need more than these big blockbusters to come out. They need kind of middle budget films to pad out the schedule, because you can't live as a theater business on blockbusters alone.
Right. And so are the movie studios making those movies anymore?
They are, but they exist in two different worlds. You have one half of the business, basically, that is making films for theaters and telling you you have to see it in IMAX or Dolby Cinema or 3D or don't bother. And then you have another part of the business that's making movies specifically for streaming. Apple is still picking up festival titles and debuting them on Apple TV Plus and in a certain number of theaters at the same time, but it's primarily a streaming play. And then, you know, Netflix has been taking a lot of oxygen out of that middle market by writing huge checks for filmmakers to create movies directly for streaming that barely touch theaters at all.
Okay, so why aren't the streamers going into the big budget movies, the action movies?
There might be three big reasons, and let's just lay them out. First of all, releasing a movie in theaters in the way that the major studios do is a highly risky proposition for your reputation and also for your bottom line. It costs tens of millions of dollars to do a nationwide and oftentimes a global marketing campaign if you're going to put a movie in thousands of theaters around the world. And the other thing is the reputational risk. You run the risk of the damage that can do to your reputation when one of those movies bombs. And you know, this is something that the studios have had to deal with for, you know, 90 years or so. But that would be a new thing for a company like Netflix or Apple TV Plus. And then, you know, they're focused on making movies to fuel subscriptions. Like that is the thing that they don't necessarily want a theatrical release to distract from. Now, the argument could be that your movie will be more popular if it's in theaters first and gets the big buzz, and people associate a certain level of quality with that. And so maybe that would, you know, boost subscriptions better. But so far, they've kind of had their feet in both sides a little bit. They've been going in. They're not just going to go into this business willy-nilly.
Okay, let me ask you about another story that's related to Top Gun. This was in the Journal today and the Wall Street Journal, and they're reporting that the huge Chinese tech firm Tencent pulled out of financing for Top Gun Maverick because it was too pro-U.S. military. What do you know about that?
No one should have been surprised that Top Gun Maverick was going to be really a pro-U.S. military. I mean, the first movie was basically a two-hour recruitment video for the U.S. Navy. I'm not really sure what they were thinking, investing in it in the first place, if that was going to be an issue. But the political realities around China and Hollywood have changed quite a bit. You know, China's movie industry has become much more nationalistic and self-contained. You know, they're not relying on a lot of U.S. blockbusters and letting in a lot of U.S. blockbusters to pad the numbers at the box office. They're primarily wanting their population to see films that glorify the party in China and their global power and all that kind of thing. And so investing in a Navy recruitment video doesn't really advance those goals.
Yeah, interesting. All right, Ryan, well, thank you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Ryan Fonder is Hollywood business reporter for the LA Times and also author of their Wide Shot newsletter. Coming up, why Tesla's claims about being self-driving are exaggerated.
The car can do some things. It can help stay in the lane and it can, you know, sort of control steering. But there's a lot of circumstances that it can encounter that it's never seen before.
A new documentary on Tesla and self-driving technology next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 6 years ago, in May of 2016, a former Navy SEAL named Josh Brown was driving along a highway in rural Florida. Ahead of him, a tractor trailer is in a road that crosses his. But Brown never slows down. It's like he doesn't even see the truck.
Are the vehicles on the road?
No, he went way off the road.
Went off into the ditch and went into the woods.
Ran off probably a quarter mile from where the wreck happened.
I watched it happen.
Okay, sir, is there any obvious injuries?
I mean, he's dead as hell.
Brown was driving a Tesla Model S on autopilot in that accident. He was a huge fan of the company and of its CEO, Elon Musk, and he was an enthusiastic early adopter of this technology. But even though Tesla called its technology self-driving, it really wasn't and still isn't. But Musk regularly muddies that fact when he talks about Tesla's cars, like when he said this in 2015, the year before Brown's fatal accident.
I almost view it as like a solved problem. Like, we know exactly what to do, and we'll be there in a few years.
Well, a new New York Times documentary looks at the disconnect between the promises Musk makes about Tesla's self-driving technology and the reality. It's called Elon Musk's Crash Course. Emma Schwartz is the film's producer and director, and she joins me now. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with that accident in 2016. What happened?
So the Josh Brown accident was the first known fatal crash involving autopilot in the United States. And what witnesses described was that the car simply slammed straight into a tractor trailer that was turning on this divided highway. And that turned out to be pretty critical because one of the findings that the government investigators found was that this technology wasn't designed to be used on highways that were not fully enclosed, where there was crossing traffic, because they couldn't always sense that. And so while Josh Brown was clearly not paying attention to the road, as you know, he had been advised in all the manuals through Tesla, at the same time, the technology was allowed to be used in areas that it wasn't designed to be used, which raised a lot of questions about what kind of, you know, safety controls Tesla had put on the technology.
Yeah. And so what did the car see, if anything, when this truck pulled in front of his car? Did it just not see the truck?
You know, we don't entirely know what the car saw. At the time, there was one camera and one radar. There's also some ultrasonics, but they wouldn't have really come into play here. And, you know, the question was, you know, did the camera not see the truck? Did the radar not sense the truck? Or did they disagree with each other and the computer didn't know exactly what to do? And, you know, Tesla hasn't fully explained, you know, why that didn't work. But what is clear from what the government investigators have found is that, you know, a lot of the companies that were trying to develop this technology didn't have good systems for sensing stationary objects on highways, which is why you didn't see a lot of these used on divided highways or city streets.
So, as you say, there was an investigation into this death on the part of NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And I just want to play a clip from your film where the former communications director, Brian Thomas, talks about a phone call that he had with Elon Musk about the investigation.
Our general counsel let them know we'd be opening this investigation and that it would be made public the following day. At that point, Elon Musk came on and just sort of started shouting, was really, really upset that we'd be opening a public investigation, accusing us of singling Tesla out. made the point several times that, you know, this was one fatality out of more than 35,000 a year. So why were we picking on Tesla and suggesting that he would sue us for opening this investigation?
Okay, so he was having a conversation. Musk was with the general counsel, and this guy was in the room listening in on that. And so why did, first of all, did Elon Musk sue NHTSA, and why was he so opposed to the investigation? I mean, you would think that he would want to improve the safety of his cars.
Yeah, so it was really surprising because I think the government official regulators who were on the call didn't expect Elon Musk to even be on this call. They were just informing the company, and usually you're not talking to the CEO when you do that. And as they were explaining, they're about to open an investigation, and NHTSA investigations are public. That's when Elon Musk jumps on the phone and threatens them. Now, you know, Elon didn't ultimately sue the agency, and you know, his staff did provide material and data to the investigators. But you know, he's a very wealthy, powerful individual, and certainly the regulators were able to continue with that. But it, you know, raised a lot of questions about, you know, how far was he going to, you know, take that.
Is there anything to Elon Musk's complaint that, look, Tesla's being picked on, that when you look at the grand scheme of things, there are so many auto fatalities in this country? Why focus on, I mean, many thousands to many tens of thousands, why focus on this one? Is there anything to that?
So I think there's sort of two kinds of criticisms that you can look at here. And one is, does Tesla get a lot more attention, you know, good and bad? And I think there is some fair, you know, concern that for good or for ill, Elon's profile, Tesla's disruptive force in the car industry has meant that it does get more attention than a lot of other car companies. That being said, you know, self-driving technology or advanced driver's assistance technology, which is what Autopilot is, was new. And at the time, government regulators really wanted to promote the new technology with the hope that it would increase safety on the roads. And many still believe that it might. And so one of the questions that they have is that, you know, we got to make sure we do this right. We got to make sure that when we deploy the technology, we don't have unintended consequences, or that we limit the unintended consequences. So if you're sitting in the position as the safety regulator and you see a fatality involving this new technology, it is something different because this has the potential to change the way driving can happen, and understanding, you know, whether or not it's being deployed safely is something that I think a lot of the government officials expressed to me as being important to look into.
So this technology is like advanced cruise control. Not only does it control the car's speed, it controls the car's steering. So you can conceivably take your hands off the wheel, your foot off the pedal, and let the car drive itself. Why is it not full autopilot?
So when you say you could conceivably take your hands off the wheel, that's sort of the rub of it all, right? Because the car can do some things. It can help stay in the lane, and it can, you know, sort of control steering. But there's a lot of circumstances that it can encounter that it's never seen before, whether it's weather, whether it's missing lane markings. And it was only designed to be used on highways because there's a lot less that happens on a highway than on a street. Right? Even if you think about cruise control, you're not usually putting it on when you're driving in city streets. So there's a lot more that computers have to do to figure out what the right decision is. And so it's just limited in what it can do. That's why it's a driver assistance system. Mm-hmm.
But it's not called that, though. It's called autopilot. And then you can spend an extra $10,000 and get something called a fully self-driving system.
So this has been one of the criticisms, right? In aviation, there's systems called autopilot, right? And in that case, trained pilots use this system, and they're still supposed to be actively involved. But, you know, you and I might hear that, and we sort of think automatic, right? We mm-hmm. think we don't have to do anything. And so there's a big gap in terms of what the public perception is about what that word means, and, you know, what it might even technically mean in aviation. And so the tension that a lot of the car companies are trying to grapple with is, how do you keep the driver engaged if you're trying to make them less engaged? It's a bit of a catch-22.
Right. So federal regulators made a couple of recommendations to try to make this technology safer. What did they recommend?
In this case, what they found in the Joshua Brown case was that, you know, they said that Tesla needed to do have a more robust system of keeping the driver engaged and to limit the technology to the roads it was designed to be used on. And, you know, what was striking was that, you know, several years later, there was, you know, one and then a third fatal accident involving Tesla drivers who were using the autopilot. And, you know, despite asking not just Tesla, but other car makers to respond to these recommendations, Tesla never responded to the government investigators, even to this day.
Wow. And so they didn't implement the recommendations?
No.
I want to play another clip from your film, and this is of some of the engineers and a journalist from the Times describing a video that Tesla made that was, I guess it was a kind of a PR video for autopilot. Here it is.
The people that were putting it together were sitting right behind me. And the autopilot group was running lap after lap that day to try to get a clean lap.
At one point, the car, while in autopilot mode, hit a fence. They patched the car up and they did another run.
And so at the very end of the day, apparently the clean lap came in. They started editing it all together.
I think my biggest problem with the video was the first line that says it's the driver was only there for a legal reason. I think it's definitely a language that's designed for marketing. We're trying to imply that the thing is fully capable of self-driving and only the evil regulators are holding us back.
So in this video, you see someone, you see the car driving itself through urban streets to the highway, to the streets, and then finding a parking spot. I mean, and then as we just heard, it was cut together to look like there were no problems whatsoever. But as we just heard, there were in making this. It took a long time to try to get this clean example. And I guess I'm wondering why all of the effort to push this technology when people at Tesla know that it's not ready to do everything that it promises?
Well, that's a good question for Elon Musk, you know, because he certainly, you know, promoted the video and the capabilities of the system. This came out, you know, around the time that he was saying, well, we've updated the hardware. All these cars now have the hardware that you need for full self-driving. We'll just sort of, you know, fix the software. We'll get that to you. We're almost there. And, you know, I think it's Raven who says it seems a bit like it's for marketing. It's a sales pitch. Now there are, you know, folks who say, well, it's meant to show what it will do, but it certainly leaves the impression that the cars are pretty close to driving themselves.
And so they're asking people to spend the $10,000 on this full self-driving package, which doesn't fully self-drive.
Yeah, I think Cade put it well when he says essentially what they were buying is the promise, mm-hmm. the promise that this technology would be delivered. And, you know, there is a history at Tesla of, you know, buying things that weren't yet ready, right? People would put orders originally on the Roadster several years before they were ever delivered. But, you know, this is a little bit different because you already have the cars, and Elon was claiming that they had all the hardware and it was just a matter of sending, you know, a computer update.
So he keeps saying, as you document in your film, that we're 2 years away from fully self-driving, where you could take a nap in the car and arrive at your destination unscathed. What is the reality? How far away are we really from that kind of technology?
You know, certainly more than 2 years away, right? I don't think, you know, everyone that I've talked to can't, you know, sort of put a hard number on it, but there were promises not just from Tesla, but from other companies, you know, around the, you know, 2010, 2015 timeframe, you know, promising that self-driving cars are going to be here by 2020, right? So it's still a long way out, and especially with the method that, you know, Tesla claims to be using, by using just cameras, it's a more complicated way to go about it.
So they're not using radar at all anymore?
Now they're not using radar, and they're also not using LiDAR, right? And they're essentially relying on having more computer power to figure it out. And, you know, there's, you know, theoretically, as people have said, maybe one day this will be possible, but it relies on, you know, levels of artificial intelligence that, you know, are still a long way off. We don't know how to recreate a human brain.
So this whole idea that the machine is safer than the human, that's not necessarily true.
Well, so here's the rub, right? A machine could potentially be safer than a human. That's not incorrect as a possibility, right? And there are probably times where you can create a machine that is safer than a human. I think the challenge with the information and data we have about autopilot from Tesla is that we just have a couple of basic numbers that they've put out. And it's sort of saying, trust us that these numbers are the fairest and most accurate way to tell you that the product we sell is the safest. And I think, you know, any journalist has to be skeptical of any numbers that are just put out by a company, especially when they're not verified and when there's not a lot of detail to back that up.
Well, Emma, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Emma Schwartz is the director and producer of the new New York Times documentary, Elon Musk's Crash Course, about the limits of Tesla's self-driving technology, which you can watch now on Hulu. Coming up, we'll meet the avant-garde composer Paola Prestini, who sometimes uses virtual reality in her pieces. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. That's a piece called We Breathe Again from the album Houses of Zodiac, Poems for Cello, composed by Paola Prestini. The album is based on a larger piece of performance art, which features music from a single cello with several poets and dancers. She is one of the most experimental composers today. She creates pieces that combine music with film, dance, even virtual reality. Well, this weekend, Paola Prestini will premiere Houses of Zodiac at the Broad Museum. And Paola joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you. Talk a little bit more about this piece and what it is and what we can expect to hear at the Broad.
Absolutely. First of all, I love that you called it performance art, because I think often, you know, people have difficulty explaining what I do, and I do think it falls in between disciplines. And it's often really born out of the collaborators that I'm working with. So Houses of Zodiac is a work that I've co-created with my husband, cellist Jeffrey Ziegler, and the filmmaker Murat Eyüboğlu. It also features and is co-created with these two phenomenal dancers, New York City Ballet soloist Georgina Paskogan and the Butoh dancer Dai Matsuoka. So it was really born in the pandemic. My husband and I were together, and he had never really kind of performed all of my cello works. And so one day he said to me, you know what, this is going to be my pandemic project. I'm going to play all your cello works. And as we set into motion, we began to realize that there was a larger piece at hand, because the pieces, you know, were inspired by these poets. And then these poets created these visceral worlds. Well, what would that mean if we brought that to stage? And so from there began these kind of discussions that essentially brought in a family of collaborators. And the kind of evolution was actually startlingly natural.
And is there a storyline to Houses of Zodiac?
You know, so the storyline, it's not really there. It's in the sense of a linear fashion, but it brings you through these deep emotions of these two characters that are, in essence, twin souls, which are portrayed by Gina and Dai. The words of these four poets, Pablo Neruda, Brenda Shaughnessy, Natasha Trethewey, and Anais Nin, inform, if you will, a loose narrative where you essentially enter these kind of different houses of a zodiac. And so you get to kind of travel through these rooms where you see flashbacks and scenes of these two characters' lives. They range from an immersion into nature to essentially kind of the revisionist aspect of a love story and how a love story could go many different ways. And all of that is narrated by Jeff's cello and this beautiful world that Murat has filmed.
Oh my gosh. Okay, that is a lot.
Yeah, but it is abstract. You know, I mean, one could look at it and take something different, you know, because the themes of the pandemic, you know, this kind of, you know, real deep searching of who am I, you know, and mm-hmm. what is the solitude and what does communion mean? You know, what does it mean to be together? So it is complex, but at the same time, it can also be just enjoyed viscerally, you know, as mm-hmm. you see these two extraordinary dancers on stage and then Jeff, you know, three virtuosos.
And then the cello kind of mediates between these two forces, the fast and the slow.
Yeah, it's a great point. Yes. I mean, the cello solos are these worlds unto themselves, you know, that are choreographed by them, by Georgina and Dai. And yeah, absolutely. He goes through a myriad range of emotion and intensity that absolutely mediates between them.
Well, let's hear a little bit more music. This is from Houses of Zodiac, and the piece is called Ophelia. Find out a little bit more about you.
Okay.
About all of these other people and their great artistic works, but how did you come to this? You were born in Italy, but you were raised in Arizona. How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my family immigrated to the United States, to the border, actually, when I was a kid. My father makes musical instruments, and the cane that was used to, you know, that he grows to make his reeds, if you will, it comes from northern Mexico. And so we made this crazy journey to the border, to actually Nogales, which is where he's still based. And then my mother and I moved actually to Tucson, Arizona. And, you know, my mom was an amazing single parent who really believed in my musical abilities. And so from a young age, I was writing music and improvising. And I guess my love of collaboration has brought me to do some pretty crazy things. And mm-hmm. I've always felt that, you know, like I studied at Juilliard. I loved studying composition, but I felt like there was a school beyond school that I needed to learn about, and that world would come actually from my collaboration with poets and filmmakers and scientists. And so that led me to have this career that allows me to kind of really follow the muse and the world of continuous, if you will, education that I feel like I need to go through in order to be the best version of an artist that I can be or that I want to be.
We'll talk a little bit more about why it is so important to you to collaborate and to work across different media instead of just focusing on opera and composition.
Sure. I mean, first of all, there's the very, you know, real story of, you know, when you follow kind of a path that's already set out in front of you, there's a tremendous amount of gatekeeping. And, you know, I experienced that firsthand as a woman composer. It really began as kind of a necessary story, right? Which was that I wasn't sure how I was supposed to have a career if I wasn't winning certain awards. And honestly, it just didn't feel like that path was the path that I could take or should take. And now it feels like I'm finally breaking into a place where people can see that you can be more than one thing. It's definitely hard, but mm-hmm. I think it's really important for younger artists to hear, you know, that there are these alternative paths out there, and that while they're difficult, sometimes they can actually speak more clearly to your muse and to who you are. You know, the work I just did last weekend in San Diego Opera, Aging Magician, you know, it was a completely non-traditional opera that people think of more as performance art. Or my next opera is about, you know, these intersections of disability and AI and what does it mean to fully have voice. So these pieces to me are more about what does it mean to be fully and essentially human.
Yeah, it seems that opera is a lot more open to experimentation and to exploring and exploding the form than, let's say, traditional classical music. Performance
yeah,
and composition.
I would say so. I mean, because it's a form that has always historically brought together different media, that it naturally has that inclination, but there's still a lot to innovate within. And also, you know, I think the field is learning from people out there doing things their own way. And I think everybody's right now trying to find different ways to bring in audiences and to be more inclusive and to kind of, you know, put forward the best versions, if you will, of the field so that we can all evolve and move forward in a better way.
Right. Okay, let's hear a little bit more music. And you referred to Aging Magician, and this is from that. It's called The Parts of Heart Clock. At the San Diego Opera last month, and it features the Brooklyn Youth Chorus. Tell us about that piece and what you are trying to say there.
Absolutely. That's, I mean, one of my favorite pieces. It's this work that I created with Rindy Eckert, who's an extraordinary performance artist, and the director, writer, and puppeteer, Julian Crouch, for the Brooklyn Youth Chorus. The Ataka Quartet is playing, and Rindy Eckert is singing. I was fascinated by the notion of how young people approach death. And I was curious at the very beginning of how we could reimagine the idea of crossing into afterlife in a new story that that we commissioned, written by Rindy, that essentially takes this aging clockmaker who fancies himself a magician. And instead of crossing the classic tale of the River Styx, you're actually crossing the East River. And instead of taking, you know, a gondola, you're taking the F train. And so the F train really came from Julian.
Which can be a version of hell, but anyway.
Which can be a version of hell, actually. That's so funny. But of course, it ends in Coney Island. And so when Julian came to United States from England, he was fascinated by the names of the subway stops. You know, you stop in Neptune, and then there's Aquarium, and there's Church. And of course, Coney Island. And so this aging clockmaker is writing a book called The Aging Magician, and you catch him right on the moment of a brink of life and death, and the choir guides him. Hmm.
Well, you come from many generations of musicians and people who make parts for instruments. Your family's company has been around for how long? More than 100 years, right?
Multiple generations, yeah.
Yeah. So how do you think your Italian heritage has made you who you are?
I love that question. I think that now, finally, I'm actually going to Spoleto this summer in Italy. I'm beginning to have more of a career in Italy, and it makes me so happy because I definitely think there's an influence there. My first opera was actually based, it was called Oceanic Verses. It was based on Italian rituals. And I think there's just as much there as there has been about being raised on a border. Hmm. I see it in me. I'm not sure exactly how, because I certainly left very young. But we like to joke that my mom is more Italian than most Italians. You know, there's something about people who immigrate, you know, that they hold on so much to their culture. And so I certainly grew up with a big love of Italian culture and opera and just the kind of, you know, very dramatic way of being Italian. Very extreme, very passionate, very, you know, all the kind of tropes kind of do exist in a certain way, but also the beautiful, beautiful cinema. You know, one of my favorite films was Chaos growing up by the Fratelli Taviani. So anyway, lots of influences. It's all there. And, you know, each world that I go in, you know, has these fragments of identity in them. Hmm.
Well, speaking of, I was on your website and you have your dreams on there. And one of your dreams, you write, is to bring the novels by Elena Ferrante, My Brilliant Friend.
Yes.
She's Italian, to the stage in opera form.
Yeah.
And why is that one of your dreams? Why do you want to do that?
Oh, okay, so that's one of my dreams because I think often female friendship isn't explored as main stage material. And the friendships with women that I've had in my life have completely transformed and made me. And so I think this friendship between these two women, which I had actually with my childhood friend, who's still my best friend, is something that I related to so intensely. My best friend and I grew up in Nogales and the kind of socioeconomic realities of that area. So there's something about that relationship between the two women and my brilliant friend and their evolution and how their love story is principal to the entire series that just makes me deeply want to bring that to the operatic stage so that women's voices are heard in a multitude of ways. And also that, you know, enough with like femicide, you know, it's like, it gets so old that every opera is about women dying. Like, sure, death is a part of the story, but like, what about all these other aspects of our relationships? You know, that's why.
So who's Lainu?
That I don't know yet. Such a good question. My gosh, I love that you looked at my website. I haven't thought about that in a while. I'll have to dream on that a bit. But yeah, that would be a treasure to be able to actually start dreaming about that piece.
Houses of Zodiac will premiere this Saturday and Sunday at the Broad Museum, composed by my guest, Paola Prestini. Paola, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for Press Play today. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.